Today on The Human Beat, we're going to rebroadcast our 2011 interview with the late Duncan Law. Law spent 44 years at Astoria's seafood lab. His discoveries were vital for Oregon's fishing industry and made hatcheries viable on the Columbia River. Law described how he worked his way through school in Astoria's canneries under the old Chinese contract labor system. The Chinese were required to live at the cannery bunkhouse. Duncan Law's story gives us a window into life in the 1920s and 30s and the special hardships faced by the Chinese.
My mother was the oldest girl in the family. There were four of them. My maternal grandfather thought, well, I'm going to marry her well. He decided that she should marry my father, George Gunlaw. And he was a college graduate, strangely enough, OSU graduate, but not Oregon State, but Ohio State. She didn't know him at all. When my father graduated, he decided to get a job. And in those days, it's very difficult for Chinese to get a job.
Right.
He came back to Portland, and there was no jobs at all, at least not for Orientals. And so he decided he'd go back to China with his diploma and flaunt that a bit. And he made an instant hit with the government back there because he was a college graduate from U.S. and with a degree. And so they hired him immediately as a horticulturist back there. My grandfather was a merchant, and he was able to come with his wife. Mm-hmm. And that's how my other side of the family, maternal side of the family, came over here. They have one son in that group. He was the first doctor in this area. He was at OHSU, you know, where they have the medical school now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he graduated from there. My mother came back to Portland, but she didn't go back to China because he was going to get a job first. And after he had been there for a little while, his brothers told my mother that she had better go back there and see what was going on. She went back to Shanghai, I guess. And I was conceived in Shanghai. The thing that really disturbed her when she went back there, she found that my father had taken a few concubines. Mm-hmm. And of course, that just infuriated her, being more American. And she tried to convince him to come back to the United States with me and the daughter. Mm-hmm. And he said no. He liked that situation. Mm-hmm. Back there. So my mother decided to leave him, and that was really unusual for those days because the Chinese just didn't separate. Well, my mother separated, and I was born in Hong Kong. She fled to Hong Kong. She had some friends. And then I was born. And the strange thing, I was born on 2/22/21, which was, strangely enough, Washington's birthday.
Well, it sounds like your mother was an independent person.
Very much so.
Was able to choose things for herself.
And she was what you would call a real go-getter.
Mm-hmm.
And she decided that she'd come back to America. She came and settled back in Portland, where she was born.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And she was a very entrepreneurial type of person, and she decided to look around for a job, which would, even those days, was very difficult because women, single mothers, would have a very hard time. And she looked around, and she was an excellent seamstress. She looked around and found that the sewing business was such that she didn't like this sweatshop stuff that they would have to do, and she took one of those jobs. So she went to beauty school in Portland and decided to be a beauty operator. And she did quite well and graduated. And she liked it so well that she taught her little younger sister, Minnie. This Minnie became so proficient at handling the curling iron and so forth that she contested the state board, mm-hmm. and she, without going to school, and she passed it and she decided she'd become a beautician. But she didn't know where to go to either to start the business, but Astoria was wild and woolly,
yeah.
And there was quite a business area. Bordellos or body houses, if you want to call them. So they wanted somebody to fix their hair. And my Aunt Min decided that would be the place to start her business. So she was doing women of the night, their hair, and going down from one, up and down the stairs from one place to another, and she thought to herself, well, this isn't very smart. I might as well build my own beauty shop, and they come to me. And so she built her shop on 8th Street across from the courthouse, and it was called the Minetta Beauty Shop. She asked my mother if she wouldn't come down and be her partner. So my mother came down, and that worked out very well. Not only the body house ladies, but everybody else that came by through, and they gained quite a reputation.
Well, this would have been when you were about 2 years old.
Yeah.
Too early for you to remember much, but what about your memories as you were growing up here? What was that like for you growing up in Astoria?
Oh, I remember very well the schoolmates that I went from the first to the fifth grade. And one of my good old friends is Ed Fury. I still see him. He comes up and sees me once in a while yet. In the summer, summers I would come down and work in the canneries because...
This was while you were going to college or going to school?
No. When I was going to high school, yeah.
You're going to high school, okay.
I was generally in the canneries. I was shooting cans down the chute because I was so little, they didn't want me to be where the big guys worked. About 1940, I had worked for CRPA for 6 years, and it was just really a tough grind, and the Chinese people had to work in the cannery using hand labor for all sorts of things. There were no jitneys or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And we pushed the wheels around and carried cans around. I never did like living down there. I didn't mind eating. We ate in a big warehouse where at 7:30, no, at 6:30, when everybody was awakened by the cook hitting on a great big saw, banging on it, and it would resound for blocks around, but the people tumbled out of bed and lined up to, after getting washed up and so forth, lined up to get the food to feed the workers at the cannery. And Bumblebee was used most labor, Chinese labor. I think what happened was I got tired of bed bugs and fleas biting me all the time. And so I quit the bunkhouse there and stayed in one of the boarding houses in Uniontown. Mm-hmm. And rather interesting enough was that when I first went to work for Bumblebee, I got off the boat that brought the a lot of the cannery fellas to work in Astoria. I didn't know what to expect. And this guy said, follow me. So I carried my bag up with him to the top of the third floor. And here was one room with a couple of bunks in it. There was another area there that had some boards and four sawhorses,
mm-hmm. Oh.
And three planks. And the guy said, you sleep there. I took my bag out and laid my blankets on the bag, and the guy suddenly said, oh, I show you, I fix you. He went downstairs, and pretty soon he came back up with, I guess it was 8 cans, big flats, mm-hmm. that would fit over the legs of the sawhorses. The old sawhorses were sitting in tins, rather, of kerosene. And I thought, wow, this guy's making a funeral pyro for me. And I asked him, what's that for? He said, you see? And I went on making the bed and wondering whether I'd be caught, whether I'd catch on fire in the middle of the night or not. Nothing happened, and I woke up the next morning, and holy smoke, there were 2 or 3 bed bugs in each sack almost. One of them didn't have any, I remember, but the others all had bed bugs in them.
So it was a pretty effective way of keeping them away.
And I thought, boy, this guy knows what he's doing. But the next night, I was sleeping, I went to sleep. It wasn't hard to fall asleep because they worked you so darn hard. Mm-hmm. So I fell asleep there, and all of a sudden, something dropped on my head, and I, like that, and it went splat, and it was a bed bug. And I jumped out of bed and looked around, and there's a small highway of bed bugs that went over the top of the ceiling up to where approximately my bed head was. And then apparently what happened, they would drop off and they would fall in my head. And holy smoke, gee, this is terrible. Anyway, I stayed there for maybe about 3 years. And they opened a bunkhouse 2, which wasn't quite so buggy. And I moved over there.
So at that time, the cannery would work with a contractor.
Yeah.
The contractor would provide the labor for the cannery.
Mm-hmm.
What was the pay like?
The pay was very small.
Yeah.
I recall that I worked all summer and only made $65 a month, I think. And they worked about 10 hours a day. Mm. And then half a day on Saturdays, I guess it was. And I recall that your overtime, which everybody wanted, was time and a half. Mm-hmm. So we all wanted more overtime, but we didn't get it too often. Mm-hmm. But in those days, the salmon was just all over the place. And it was so thick on the floor that some years when the salmon runs were very high, we'd have to really work late and start early in the morning to keep up with the runs. And in those days, it was really labor intensive, because they didn't have automatic de-headers, and they finally got automatic de-headers, and they had gang knives, and the butchers would butcher the fish, and the guys would take the fish down and grate them, and the gang knife guys would cut the fish into the right size and deliver them to the fillers. I worked there until 1940. One of the bosses there came to me and said, "We're going to transfer you over to Ilwaco." Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, gee, that is kind of a raunchy deal. What are they trying to do? I told him, "You can't force me to go to Ilwaco. Yeah, I quit." I said some things in Chinese that weren't very nice.
You learned more Chinese, yeah, by then.
And I stomped out of there, and I got back to the place where I was staying in Uniontown, and cried my eyes out, because I thought, oh, that was really stupid, because what I did was throw my college education out. Yeah. See, I was already in college then. I worried about that for a long time. When I went, I decided to start college anyway, continue college. Mm-hmm. And when I went back there, it was my sophomore year. In those days, it was cheap to go to college. Mm-hmm. Tuition was about $400 a year, and room and board was a little over, about $35 a month. Mm-hmm. Just about the time when I had just about given up going to college, when Pearl Harbor happened. And it just came like a ton of bricks, you know. It happened that Point Adams, down the way here, hired all Japanese for their crew. And so they hired Ed Lee for their Chinese gang master. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing you know, he heard that I had quit Bumblebee, so he hurried up and phoned me and asked if I wouldn't work for him. And I just was happier than a clam, you know, at low tide. So I was able to finish school with the small money that I had made during that season. After the winter semester, I worked for Point Adams, and they were an excellent place to work, because they even paid better salary than what the Bumblebee did. And I worked there till I graduated, and that was back in 1944 when I graduated.
Sounds like you had a little bit of that same independent streak your mother had.
Oh.
And it turned out well for you.
Well, it certainly did. And, you know, it's extremely lucky. My wife isn't here. But when I went to work down at Boyd Adams, Ed Lee was the person that hired everybody. And he had four daughters. And I was very fortunate to marry one of his daughters.
Well, that worked out well for you in every way.
It worked always. Yeah, 44.
Mm-hmm. Now, what did you major in school? How did that come together?
Well, I was majoring in chemistry, and I look back at it now, indeed, if you majored in chemistry, you had to get at least a master's in order to get a job of any consequence. I went ahead and tried to find another major. I thought about microbiology and took quite a bit of that. And I thought, well, maybe biology would be pretty good. And I took quite a bit of that. I took courses in physics. And every one of them turned out pretty good because after 4 years, I didn't have any major. So the only thing I could graduate, and I was running out of money then. The only thing I could graduate was general science. Mm-hmm. And boy, that just fit in like a glove. And the seafood lab was extremely interested, but they didn't have very much money to pay people. So they sent a fella up, Professor Russell Sinuber, to find some person from Oregon State that wanted a job in fisheries in Astoria. And boy, oh boy, I took one look at that and I said that would be the job for me, because even though, say, if I wanted to work in the shipyards in Portland or some other job in Portland, they would be much higher paying, but they didn't offer the interest to me. Mm-hmm. And that interest in work to me was the most important. And so when they offered this job of work at the seafood lab, I jumped at it, because that's exactly what I wanted.
And you kind of rose through the ranks there.
Yeah, and I was hired as research assistant at first. Mm-hmm. And I gradually rose up from research assistant to assistant prof and associate prof and full prof, and then prof emeritus now.
Well, that turned out to be a good thing for you, but a very good thing for the seafood lab and for the seafood industry, because you accomplished a great deal.
Yes, I think I have. When we first started, we worked on fish livers, and I wrote a paper on fish livers off the Oregon coast, and we took every fish that we could look at the vitamin A level of those fish. And vitamin A was such an important vitamin, because in the war they needed it for pilots to fly. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese were at war with us, so they wouldn't sell us any vitamin A. And the Germans are sinking all the ships from Norway and so and that area there. So we weren't getting any vitamin A from that area. Hmm. So all of a sudden they found that shark livers had a lot of vitamin A in it. And a few other fish over here all had vitamin A in their livers. So fish liver fishing became quite profitable.
We're talking with Duncan Law, whose research at the OSU Seafood Laboratory in Astoria resulted in the Oregon moist pellet, which is still used in salmon rearing worldwide. He tells us about that development.
The hatcheries were all using salmon viscera. And it seemed like in most places, wherever they put a hatchery, it began to drop in their egg take. Mm-hmm. And many of the places didn't ever make their egg take. Mm-hmm. They were thinking about closing those down. Mm-hmm. And I thought for a darn long time, why was this salmon viscera not working? We, developing a method, because I had a lot of microbiology, I knew that if you shot the milk through pipes where they were surrounded, the pipes were surrounded by the temperature that would destroy the bacteria, pathogens, but not necessarily all of them, but just the pathogens. Mm-hmm. It would work pretty good, and the fish would like it. The other way they did it, before I figured that method out, nothing seemed to appeal to the fish. And this method we used to pasteurize the fish viscera, particularly salmon viscera, well, they thought that was really the cat's meow, because it certainly made the fish grow better, because we were pasteurizing the fish and the material that the pathogens that were making the fish sterile really worked. Mm-hmm. And so, matter of fact, the way I knew that we were doing a good thing was because the Fish and Wildlife, Federal Fish and Wildlife people had a meeting, and I was one of the guest speakers at this meeting. And they said they were about to close most of the hatcheries on the Columbia because they weren't making their egg take. Mm-hmm. And they kind of assumed that every area that they put a hatchery on seemed to decrease in eggs. Mm-hmm. After a few years.
It's making things worse,
yeah.
In a way, rather than better, yeah.
And they didn't realize that the raw viscera was the one that was causing the trouble.
The late Duncan Law, eminent seafood researcher and preeminent citizen. This is The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca.